The year is 1989, and somewhere between Beetlejuice and Drop Dead Fred lies this grotesque nightmare fuel of children's entertainment. Fred Savage plays 11-year-old Brian Stevenson, a young man whose parents are facing potential divorce and a younger brother plagued by nightmares of monsters under the bed. After switching bedrooms with his little brother, he realizes the nightmares were in fact reality, as he is pestered by a precocious and obscene monster named Maurice. After a series of mischievous pranks, Brian realizes if you can't beat him, join him, and enters the monster's underworld to escape the drama that his parents are creating in the real world above. Brian learns, however, that his presence in the underworld is robbing him of his humanity, and faces a serious choice between a life of structureless fun with his friend Maurice or staying in the real world with his family in director Richard Greenberg's Little Monsters. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Okay, we lightly touched on this when we discussed it on the episode last week about, hey, this is something I haven't really seen since I was younger, and this was almost like a fresh revisit. I knew exactly what it was. I knew who was in it. I remembered a lot about this movie. The question was, Justin, was I going to appreciate it with the nostalgia goggles like we do with some of these things, or would I find it as a grotesque display of depravity the way our critics did? And I still love it. I thought it was great. I think it was very daring. And I would even say it's better now than it was then, because I can appreciate grotesqueness. And I miss the days of the 80s and 90s where we could actually treat kids like adults and let them decide what they thought was obscene and what wasn't. The days of Beavis and Butthead, the old days of The Simpsons, the days of Ren and Stimpy. This movie reminded me of when we were just a little bit more raw and rugged and rough and ready back in the late 80s, early 90s, and it made me long for those days. Is it a good movie? No. But do I love what it does? 100%.
You stole exactly kind of the summary I would have gone with. Because
good.
We've had this conversation before where it's hard to separate the nostalgic love between our childhood and what we see now. And this one is the king of the hill, where you have everything that kids want to see in a movie that makes you look at your parents and say, should I be watching this? It has swear words. It has toilet humor. It has, we complain about fart jokes now, and they had this movie that has every line that is so filthy, so naughty, so dirty that I didn't recognize a lot of these lines up until now. Now, again, like you, is it a good movie? 100% absolutely not, because this one at the time, I can understand why my parents hated this movie. But as a kid, like I said in our previous episode, it scared me. It made me feel icky. And I loved every minute of it as a kid because it touched every aspect of what I wanted from a movie as a kid. I loved to be scared. I loved to feel kind of uncomfortable. I loved to laugh. So this movie, as a kid, we can see the obvious target audience, but this is typical early 80s, 90s. Let's kind of push the envelope towards these kids and see what we can get away with. And that's the appreciation aspect of it that I really did enjoy about this movie. Now, I cringed a lot after my multiple rewatches this week, and it is a cringy movie as an adult.
Well, it's cringy, and I think that is a good reflection of us having matured into people that are like, oof, I really wouldn't want my kids to see this. But honestly, I tried watching this with my son and he had zero interest whatsoever. He is just of a different generation, of a different world. And then my little daughter, who loves monsters and stuff like that, she had fun with it, but also she's only 3 years old, so she kind of tuned out. So for me, I think where this has to go, and I think I'm going to talk negatively about it first before I really start praising it more. I am 100% confident in my assessment that this really lies right in between the world of Beetlejuice and then Drop Dead Fred a few years later. All cult classics, right? But this one had a more targeted audience to kids, where Beetlejuice was for kind of everybody. And Drop Dead Fred, although it feels like a kid's movie, deals with a lot more mature issues that kids wouldn't understand. Issues like divorce and infidelity and mental illness. It hits a lot harder watching it as an adult than I recognized when I watched it as a kid over and over and over again. And this one's kind of right in between, and this one is definitely more for the kids. This is kind of like where if Drop Dead Fred existed in a world for children, not the grown-up version of a child. And that's what I liked about it. So where do I have issues with it now? I'm going to tell you, man, it's 100% technical, storytelling-wise, filmmaking-wise, structure-wise. Because when it comes to the costumes, the performances, and the world-building, it's perfect for a child. But me with a cinematic eye, I can see where it is Beetlejuice without the budget. It is a proto version of what Pixar tried to do with Monsters, Inc. And I feel Monsters, Inc. borrowed a lot from this. But the underworld is very, it leaves much to be desired in terms of detail. It does kind of feel like a junior high school production once you get down there. Now, the idea of it and the devotion to the aspect of it, I think, works, because you can tell they really knew what they wanted, but you can also see that they didn't have the dollars to do it. And now, in this day and age, and with my kind of cinematic eye, I definitely see that, and it does take me out of it.
Yeah, and with me, the issues are 100% agreement with a lot of the technical, but I also, which I'm probably going to get some pushback on, would be the Howie Mandel casting on it. But the editing on it was my biggest issue with it, because it does cater to a lot of the rough attention span of children, where a lot of the editing doesn't make sense. And when we get to this underworld, the vision of it really doesn't make sense either, because it's claustrophobic. It's more like a visual hell. There's nothing of curiosity or of imagination to it. It is an ugly underworld. And I think it could have worked if they actually brightened it up a little bit, because we do have that Monsters, Inc. kind of feel that came out years and years later. And I think that's the aspect that we could have really had this improvement upon this movie. But more specifically, the casting of Howie Mandel throughout my rewatch, it reminded me of, God, this almost feels like it was written for Robin Williams, where there needed to be some improvisions here, where Howie Mandel, which our critics are going to talk about, it to me felt really, really forced. And at that time, it could have worked because there was nothing to set the standard. And I think that really does affect my rewatch value, is because we've seen some great performances, some great improv in movies. And this one did taint me a little bit when it comes to the rewatch value of it, because Howie Mandel at that time could have been good, but at the same time, it is really the main aspect of my cringiness during the rewatch.
I agree with you 100%, because I really just feel that he is doing a poor man's version of Michael Keaton's Beetlejuice. And they even say that in the review. But it really is. Like, that's what it is. The grunts in his voice, a lot of the kind of like side comments and snide remarks after he's said his main piece of dialogue to Fred Savage, it is very Beetlejuice adjacent. So there isn't a lot of originality in that. And also, I like Howie Mandel as a personality, but like, his stand-up was never anything great. It was mostly kind of prop comic-y, the way Carrot Top is. You take away the dude's rubber glove and his silly voices, he doesn't really have much. And I feel that performance in this movie kind of speaks to that. But what saves it for me is the fact that it's not all on Howie Mandel's shoulders. There are other characters in this that helps supports it. Fred Savage, 100%. He really carries the movie on his shoulders, because he has to have the two sides of the emotional coin. He has to be the kid going through the real human emotions of a family in turmoil, parents getting divorced, little brother, bullies at school. And then he has to go through this phase of like, okay, he's terrified of this monster. Then he's disgusted by it. Then he's enthralled by it. And now he kind of wants to be one, right? That's a lot for a child actor to have to go through in this movie, and he does it really, really well. If it was a weaker child actor, I don't think the movie would be nearly half as entertaining, because Howie Mandel is very generic and kind of tiresome. I do like, though, the attempts at the creativity of the other monsters in the underworld. I like Rick Dukeman in his, you know, big grotesque character. I like Rick Dukeman in anything. He's a very he's very of the 80s and 90s, and we didn't get a whole lot after, you know, the mid 90s with him. But I'm really, really happy when I see him in this movie, and I forgot that he was in it. And he does kind of bring that kind of, you know, villainous, almost like the Steve Buscemi character in Monsters, Inc. It's very adjacent to that, too. So I think that those characters, the makeup, even though it's not as good as Beetlejuice, the special effects, even though they're not as good as Beetlejuice, still make this an entertaining yarn. And I like the kid performances in the real world, too. You know, I like the bully. I like, well, the bully is Buzz from Home Alone, which is great. But at the same time, like, I think that there is enough that works in this movie that really kind of plasters over the things that shouldn't work for it.
Well, I think the biggest win of this movie, and I think it's overlooked a lot, is when it, especially at this time, where we take the beginning introduction, the first act, where we see this conflict between the parents, this constant arguing, and then we fast forward to the climax where we see Fred Savage really stand up, because to me, that is a more underlying message of the things kids go through to really show a power of nothing compares to what goes on in the home, to how it builds us in our confidence, and it builds us in nothing can destroy me more than the things I'm dealing with currently. So we have the bully, we have the conflict of the parents, and this is really a symbolic message that at times I do wish that the movie did focus on, because it really can be a powerful message when it comes down to it. But again, I get this is a movie not intended for that, but I think I will give credit to the filmmakers that they at least throw that in to show the superhero aspect of Fred Savage. To me, and then when we get into the creature aspect of it, to me, this is where I'm going to really say I didn't like the design, because I think they made it almost a little too grotesque, where it almost feels like it should be in a completely different movie, because this is where we get that really dark, hell-like feeling. And I kept asking myself during my rewatch is, who in the hell would want to trust this damn thing? This is something that's terrifying. It has razor teeth, and it reminded me of the Sonic design when Sonic the Hedgehog original design came on. Is, why would we have this on screen? It looks creepy as hell, and it should have been caught in the beginning of pre-production of the character design of, let's just change the teeth and make it a little bit more gentle, because there's nothing in this movie until we get to the climax that really screams danger. We want to have that fun environment. We want to have this fun character. And I couldn't stop looking at Howie Mandel's teeth, because it's terrifying.
He's a monster. This is where I disagree with you, because I think Monsters, Inc. is exactly what you're talking about, where you want your characters to be gentle and approachable enough that you can follow them through the whole movie. But the whole point of this movie is that Mandel is a monster. His job is to scare kids, and they don't get scream energy that runs their city like in Monsters, Inc. They just want to scare kids. And I think it's really a wise choice of the screenwriters, we'll get to that in a second, of making them deplorables, because then it makes us feel for our main character of not wanting him to be a deplorable. It's almost like the Pinocchio going to Pleasure Island and becoming a donkey, right? Like, it's all fun and games until you're a donkey and you can't go home. That's what this film is kind of representing, where that we're not supposed to like these guys. And you can see where he holds on to his humanity in the scene, which is very disturbing, but I love that it went there, where you've got this whole gang of monsters wanting to scare an infant. And that scene is very, very rough. I was like, oh my God. They are not getting anything out of this other than the fact that they just want to scare the hell and traumatize this infant. But I love that it went there. I respected that. And it makes Fred Savage's determination to not go that route show that he has that humanity, that this divorce and family trauma hasn't broken him. So I love the fact that these are not likable monsters. I love the fact that they really are just bad guys, and the analogy they're making of this kid can save himself from it. So that's where I will push back a little bit, because Monsters, Inc., there's a genteelness to it, where this one, there's not. They are just literal monsters.
I can see what they were going for, but then we go back to the direction of it. Is I think the transition between the relationship build between Maurice and Fred Savage didn't take enough time, because this is where I think it could have worked, and I think I could have felt for it, and I think my focus could have been distracted to a different element if they actually had to build a chemistry, but it is too rushed to really build that. We have the traps. We have the, okay, you trapped me, you caught me. Let's build this generic relationship. So now we're okay, and I accept you as a sharp-toothed, blue-pimpled, horned monster. I get it. So I think it could have worked, and I can see that point of view, if they would have taken their time on the chemistry build, because it is just force-fed and we're just there to accept it. And again, as a kid, as I spoke to earlier, it did work with the editing of the attention span, where we just need to keep this movie going along. But again, it's the inner kid versus the adult, where as the adult, I see that flaw where I could have bought in as an adult if they had a little bit more build. But as a kid, again, I don't care, because it was everything that I wanted from a movie. It's going to be, again, one of those butt reviews.
And you watch it several times like I did. Don't forget, though, that Maurice was not supposed to be scaring Fred Savage. He was supposed to be scaring the little brother. Monsters aren't so supposed to be scaring kids as old as Fred Savage, and that's what makes this story work, is that they did a switcheroo on the bedrooms, and Maurice didn't know that he was scaring an 11, 12-year-old kid who now has the wherewithal of the world to understand what the monster under the bed could be and how to capture it, where the younger brother, if it was still his room, he's just going to get terrified. That's the whole point. That's why the movie works for me, is because it wasn't supposed to be Fred Savage. It just happened to be him because they switched rooms. I think that part of the story makes that whole dynamic work, but we'll probably go on and on if we don't get off of this. Let's talk about the screenwriters. Terry Rossio and Ted Elliott, two of the biggest screenwriters in the world right now. Prolific, but they've got a lot of great projects, and they have a lot of successful projects. And you and I can both agree, successful doesn't always mean good. But we're talking about Pirates of the Caribbean. They wrote Aladdin. They're doing all these big Disney franchises, right? These guys are, in the screenwriting world, essentially royalty. But you got to start somewhere. And they started with Little Monsters. It kind of reminds me that two of my favorite screenwriters, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who wrote Ed Wood, they did the Dolomite movie, they did Man on the Moon, they started off with Problem Child, which I think has like a 0.3% on Rotten Tomatoes. You gotta start somewhere. So the fact that two of the biggest screenwriters in the world started their career with this movie, oh man, that's like poetic to me when I see that their first writing credits were Little Monsters.
Well, you can see some love put into this movie, and kind of reviewing the IMDb profile of this, it doesn't shock me that we can see a consistent heart and grow in their movies, from Aladdin to Pirates of the Caribbean, and we won't put in Godzilla and Kong, the new empire, that doesn't count. But a lot of the...
Made money.
100%. But a lot of the family-targeted movies, it is a crescendo of heart that we see put in. So Little Monsters, we can see little tidbits of what they're trying to do. And with each movie, we see a growth of our writers really put their own individual elements into this. And you know what? There is, again, appreciation for that. And I'm not going to sit here and say I don't see that in this movie, because I'm going to complain more than I'm going to compliment this movie. But it's so easy to do. It's an easy target for that. But there is heart in this movie, and the heart does shine through by the end of the climax. So I do see it going into the future of these writers, and this was their stepping stone.
I will honestly say that without this movie, we don't get Shrek, because they wrote Shrek. And so much of Maurice, you can tell, is in Shrek. That grotesque monster that doesn't like anybody at first and then slowly warms up to this person and becomes redeeming at the end. I was like, oh my God, this is like the proto version of what they end up doing with one of the biggest franchises of all time. So they've got a style, they got a formula, and a lot of their movies follow the same beats, which is natural. Like, if it works, it works, you know? Beatles song chorus, verse chorus, verse chorus, it's the same thing. So yeah, I just had to throw that out there, that those two guys who wrote this movie, man, they wrote it all the way to the bank because they've used this particular dynamic many, many times. The director, Richard Greenberg, so he originally was a title sequence director, and that's what kind of won him this role. And then he had a lot of the makeup designers from Beetlejuice. Like, they literally stepped right off of Beetlejuice into this. And you can tell there's a lot of the special effects, there's a lot of makeup effects, and a lot of character quirks that are very reminiscent of some of the creatures that we see in Beetlejuice, just a little less detailed because they didn't have a budget. I like that, but it also made me long for more of the lore of what makes the monsters, because the way I've always perceived it, and even more so now in this, you know, third rewatch I've done for this episode, is that monsters are essentially children that were brought into the underworld and stayed there. Like, that's the way I interpreted it. Is that the way you did too?
Yeah, that's exactly. And that's where I kind of got that hell element, or what the intent of these monsters right. were, of making it even more amplified of the terror of these things.
Right. And then there is a moment at the end where the bully character, played by Buzz from Home Alone, he's like, cool. He's like, dude, I'll stay down here. I kind of like being a monster. It almost makes me think that all the monsters were at one point bullies. And the main monster that kind of leads them all, a very young Frank Whaley in the character of Boy, which is a really cool design. It's a grotesque character where essentially we have who knows what kind of grotesque monster underneath this boy face that's been stretched and stitched in the back. Very Clive Barker Cenobite, which I love. That's how cool this movie is to me. It's like, okay, this is a kid's movie, and we're literally showing you like Clive Barker monsters in it. I like that part of the lore. I just wish they would have delved further into it. So that's one of my biggest complaints of the movie, is there was so much missing lore that would have been interesting of how this underworld actually operates, how it recruits kids to be monsters. And we didn't get enough of that. Instead, we were focusing on the friendship of Maurice and of Fred Savage. But now I want to see a version where it's all about the monster world, because that's terrifying and fascinating. And I don't think we got enough to understand really what the stakes were, other than if you stay there long enough, you become a monster.
Yeah, I mean, there was a comic book 6-issue thing that came out after the movie that touched a little bit on it.
Yeah.
But to me, I think this is where as an adult, I wanted more of that, because you nailed it. The Boy, this is one of the more interesting monsters of this world, and we don't get enough of it. We just get it kind of thrown in, and it is the monster of disguise. It's the most terrifying, because we don't know what he's going to do. We don't know what's underneath, and then we finally see him, and we don't really get a backstory to him, and in a way, I do respect that, but at the same time, this is where it feels like there's missing pieces throughout this movie.
Right.
And it almost would have been better just to stick with the one villain. But going into the butt review, at the same time, The Boy is such an interesting visual, and it's such a great performance to watch, that it adds more terror than any other monster in this world, because you don't know the intent. It's subtle and it's sinister. So these are the things that are the main definitions of kind of what you touched on. The bully aspect of it is the unknown of what's going to happen next.
I think there's also a hidden analogy that they don't come out, you know, right out front and say it, but there is something very sinister about Daniel Stern's performance as his dad that I never really noticed as a kid. You can tell he's a very unhappy, but he's also a very angry man. And so the manifestation of that anger and what it does to the family, and especially his two young boys, I think also can be a metaphor for what the monsters represent and what draws the monsters there. If, and this is me just being, you know, tinfoil hat, making my own interpretations of this movie, it's almost like Poltergeist, right? If there's family trauma, if there is anger and depression and turmoil, then that makes the family more susceptible for monsters to come and mess with the little kids, because they're already in an emotionally weakened state. It's so works psychologically if you look at it that way, and that makes the movie even that much more interesting to me, even though it's not in the subtext. But I feel like that is part of what the analogy they're trying to say is that Daniel Stern's a bad dad. It's a bad marriage. The mom is obviously in the right. I mean, she's not being super supportive for the kids, but she's in the right where it's like, this guy is kind of a piece of shit. And the turmoil that the kids are going through, it's breaking them down emotionally. And that is what is causing the monsters, or in some sense, people say demonic possessions the same way. If you're weak in resolve and if you're weak in your idea of self-worth, then you can get captured by darkness. So it's a dark way to look at it, but it makes so much sense to me now watching this as an adult.
Preying on the vulnerable is, in some opinions, would be a cheap shot, but I don't see that here. And that's one of the things I will go to defense up and down with this movie, because it just makes sense. And the dad, I think to an extent, he's a character here. Somebody in this relationship, given the runtime, has to be the bad guy, and it's not going to be mom. It has to be the stern dad character, and
works too hard, commutes too long. We all know that. Most of us grew up with parents like
100%. That. 100%. And you know what? When it comes to the underlying messages that I spoke to earlier, this is one of those that can have multiple layers. And again, I've said it before, this is one of those movies I wish did kind of have a remake, because addressing a lot of this criteria and a lot of this substance can go a long way in modern times. But again, this isn't the movie they sought out to do. So I can put on my tinfoil hat on this one too and pinpoint a lot of the messaging themes and everything it's going for. And it hints at it dramatically in this movie. But it never really spends enough time to really go after it. But by the end of the movie, as an adult, we can appreciate what the brief snippets of messaging it tries to do. We can appreciate what the dad character is. We can appreciate what the mom's trying to do. We can appreciate what the kids are trying to do, all the way up to Fred Savage standing up to save his brother at the end. So there's a lot of great messaging here that adults will take more than kids. And that's what kind of really makes this movie good, if you take away a lot of the naughty language and the naughty, disgusting fart pee jokes and all that, is kids are going to understand the overall kind of messaging to a simplistic level. Adults will read between the lines. And that's what I think is really underappreciated about this movie, if you can just ignore the ugly look of it.
I mean, we've seen quite a few movies do this before. I mean, we almost pretty much talked about one a few weeks ago with Man Without a Face, where I don't think we see so much of it now in this current generation. It's a whole different problem that parents are dealing with. But this movie does represent the era of the 80s and 90s where parents were so involved with work and themselves, they had no idea what was going on in their kids' lives. They had no idea if they were being bullied at school. We were free-range children, go out and play, come home before the streetlights come on. Like, that's the world this movie exists in. And so it is an interesting kind of, you know, page in the book of human history where we see this era where, like, kids were not raised by helicopter parents. They were free range, and the parents, blink of an eye, your kids are on the other side of the continent, right? They're in Malibu and you live in New Jersey or wherever they are. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting motif on that. So let's hear what our critics had to say, and they didn't have anything good.
The movie is named Little Monsters, and because it stars Fred Savage, who's become so popular through the TV show The Wonder Years, it's likely to attract audiences made up of families and younger children. And boy, are they going to get a surprise. Little Monsters is one of the most repellent, distasteful, truly creepy movies I've seen in a long time. A movie so unpleasant, I can't really figure out why anybody wanted to make it, and I don't know why anybody would want to see it.
It very much reminds me of the Ninja Turtles critique, right? Like, yes, there are audiences for this movie, Roger and Gene. It's not just you. And it went way over your head, and you let the surface of the grotesqueness and the obscenity and the fart jokes and the piss jokes blind you to all of the subtext that you and I were just talking about, which at the end of the day is extremely interesting. But again, that might not be critic mindset. That is film appreciator mindset. That is, I'm going to rent this movie several times as a child for sleepovers and learn more about it each time I watch it. Subtext. So yeah, it's easy for them to say that, but disagree.
Interesting. 100%. But are they wrong? I wouldn't say so, because at this point, it even took my second rewatch to really kind of grasp a little bit of this messaging and what it's tried to do. So, and again, to the defense of these two, this is a one and done. This is one that they have to go with a grain of salt and say, this one looks ugly, it feels ugly, it sounds ugly, and I just didn't connect with it. And even us as adults now, we can see the flaws. Going with a film critic back then, this is where they automatically saw the flaws. And this is a movie that wasn't a huge success. I mean, out of almost a $5 million budget, only did like almost $800,000. Word of mouth got out on what kind of movie this really was. And I think it's because of these first reactions of what in the actual hell did I just watch?
Well, and also it's kind of like, I mean, we didn't have trigger warnings back then or content warnings. So it would be someone like a film critic or a critic in a newspaper that could tell you, hey, this isn't a kid's movie for everybody. Like, if you don't want your kids seeing a monster pee in a cup and give it to a kid to drink, then don't go see it. So I get it. I understand the, you know, hazard lights they put on this movie, but it is my right to disagree with it. He goes on.
I don't know who this movie was intended for. It's obviously not for adults who couldn't care less about monsters in the woodwork or under the bed, but it has too many offensive scenes and concepts in it for it to be appropriate for smaller children. And even kids who love monsters are likely to be turned off by the Howie Mandel character. Now, I have to give Mandel credit for a good acting job. He does create an incredibly unlikable and repulsive monster, and he does a good job of that. It's just that the whole movie feels unwholesome and deeply troubled and really creepy, and I didn't enjoy myself for one second while I was watching it. And afterwards, I thank God that I wasn't 8 years old, because then I would never be able to go into a bedroom again.
Okay, so in a way, he's given that movie a backdoor compliment, because it did what it was supposed to do, make an impression on your mind of like, oh, wow, you know, monsters aren't necessarily the best friends. You know, they're scary. Monsters are monsters. I still think there's a subtext to it. But also, I don't know, is it a backdoor compliment or a complimentary insult to say that Howie Mandel did a great job? Because you and I both agree that it seems very forced. It's very energetic, but it's almost like it reeks of trying too hard. But he does say it comes off great as a repulsive character that he is disgusted by. Okay, that's kind of a compliment. But at the same time, that's just how Howie Mandel acts. And it's not very good, because it's not an original performance. It's just him.
It's so cringy that it's the only thing that gave relief to the ugliness I think Roger saw.
Yeah.
And what he did really get wrong is, we were kids during this movie. I loved it as a kid.
Me
so
too.
Because it had so many taboo things that kids really wanted. But as I go on my show and I complain about just too many fart jokes, we have a line in this movie that Howie Mandel states that the best friend a man has is his right hand. And I didn't even realize that until the rewatch. So there's a lot where I can see the point of view where, who is this movie for? Because they really do push the envelope on some of this dialogue that really will go over kids' heads, but the adults will enjoy. So I think he's right to an extent where they really kind of cater to both sides, but they never really find a balance between it. But at the end of the day, kids love the taboo aspect of this. They love the feeling of being kind of uncomfortable, scared. So this was targeted more for kids, and I think it was unintentional.
You know, it's something that it really made me think about it when I was watching this movie, where it's like, yeah, most kids that were going to go see this movie were going to go see it with their parents. Their parents were going to bring them into the theater and, for all intents and purposes, probably walked them right back out, because it's just too much for young kids. But think about some of the things that we grew up with that we absolutely love. My parents did not condone me watching a lot of the stuff I watched. Where did I see it? At a friend's house, at a sleepover. You know, we'd go to the Blockbuster, rent a bunch of movies, and put the one that we really wanted to see at the bottom of the stack so our parents didn't see it. You know, Beavis and Butthead. Every kid watched it, even if they weren't allowed to. That's what the 80s and 90s were all about. we were essentially teaching ourselves how to be sneaky, how to be incognito with our material and the things that we liked, because we knew our parents wouldn't approve. This movie feels like it was made for that audience, where I know studios aren't this smart, but maybe the writers and the filmmakers were, where they're like, hey, we might not get them in the theater, guys, but we'll get them on cable. We'll get them with rentals, which they did. The rental on this was huge, because kids know their parents don't want them to see this, because they don't want them to reenact the behaviors. So they're going to watch it in private with their friends and sleepovers, and it's going to get like a cult following. And it did. So again, I'm not saying that's intentional, but it reeks of that, right? It reeks of, this was the era where we know that kids are not going to be watching this with their parents. So we're going to create something they're going to want to watch on their own or secretly with their groups. Comic books have been doing it for years, right? Mom and dad aren't going to read the story of a comic book. They're just going to thumb through it and see if there's anything inappropriate picture-wise. And that's how this movie plays. They're going to attack the hot topic moments of farting and peeing in jars and masturbation jokes and, you know, profanities, but they're not going to pay attention to the real meaning of the story. It's a great red herring, and even if it's not intentional, that's the way I see it.
Well, it even goes into the stereotypical kind of dad in this movie, where they're not being monitored 100%. Even Fred Savage at one point is sneaking an onion peanut butter sandwich and watching late night TV. That's exactly how I think a lot of kids watched this movie, is because it wasn't really sought out. So now, when we have our writers really have this idea, that could have been their absolute intent of the childhood aspect of sneaking content prior to the internet days, of course, and really watching that with a hand on a dial. They hear their kid, if they hear the parents coming, and turning that dial to something appropriate. That's how I watch a lot of my content, is just having my hand on that little dial and switching the channel when mom and dad came in.
Kids these days don't understand the importance of the return/recall button on the TV remote. You know, where you would have it like on the Disney Channel, then you type in channel 47 and you had your thumb at the ready on that recall button. So if your parents walked downstairs, it would take you right back to whatever PBS that you're watching. Like, yeah, that was our life back then. And kids don't really have to worry about that now.
Yeah, it wasn't clearing the internet history. It was just one button on a remote, because that's how we got a lot of our content.
Shit.
And that's how we had our generation that has almost, dare I say, a bigger appreciation for film because of that reason, is because a lot of this content was kind of taboo for a lot of youth.
Yeah, and the youth these days were raised by guys like us that were doing that. So it's like we don't even bother monitoring a lot of the stuff they do anymore. We know that they have way too much tech that we don't stand a chance catching them in anything.
100%. And this is one of those movies that if you weren't sure what you were watching, just out of just pure mindset, your finger is going to be on that button. It's going to be on the dial. You hear a line of dialogue. You're like, oh, I better get ready in case mom and dad walks in, even though this could have been intended for just kids. But you had that question mark of, should you be watching it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. First of all, let's get specific, because obviously some very specific images bothered you, and they bothered me as well. I don't think it's a particularly great idea for a kid's film to show somebody urinating into a apple juice bottle.
And then giving the juice to another kid to drink.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't think that makes a lot of sense. Putting saran wrap over the toilet seat. I mean, these are, you know, sometimes they can be funny jokes the way they're handled, I suppose, but they don't work in this picture. It's like a primer for how to really screw up your whole neighborhood and family. I mean, and then there's a whole bunch of sequences involving the little kids in the underworld world where they're all dressed up as sort of punk rockers and all this. And I just felt sorry for the kids that had to put on those costumes.
There's a glorification of images of death in the movie. All the people in that underworld seem to be decayed.
That's correct.
Diseased, depraved in some way or another.
Yeah.
In a way that, if it is supposed to be funny to kids, it's only funny to kids who are already apparently tuned into that kind of sick material.
Well,
I don't like to think the kids would like that.
By knocking this picture so hard, you know, we probably are sending a few people to it out of curiosity. The same stuff could be handled well. By comparison, Beetlejuice is a terrific film. I didn't think it was all that great, but by comparison, that film had a little joy to it. This is kind of depressing.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there, because what's perfectly clear about this is they don't understand the movie. They are taking the movie 100% at face value for what they see visually and not really taking the time to think about what the subtext is, like we've talked about for the last 40 minutes. He said something there that I think really, he almost walked into the point where he's like, I don't understand how kids would want to see a movie like this. It's because you don't understand how kids think and you don't understand how kids are living their lives, especially in this era. This was an era that was so jumbled in its identity of censorship and free speech. Like, we were seeing more and more violence and nudity and stuff like that on TV, but we were getting ratings on our video games and parental advisory warnings on our music that the younger generations did not understand what was right, what was wrong. Therefore, we just wanted everything. And these guys are too old to understand that audience. They're too old to understand what kids are actually facing in times like this, where 1 minute you're watching Ninja Turtles, but then you're also being sold Rambo and RoboCop toys, R-rated films that they shouldn't even be watching, but you're getting marketed to children for these things. That is the world of the 80s and 90s that we grew up in. These guys don't understand that because they're not kids. They are middle-aged film critics. So it's easy for them to think, oh, you kids and your rap music and your violent video games and these grotesque movies. But that literally is what brought us up to be the way we are. Someone made those for us. They just didn't appear out of nowhere. And I think that this movie perfectly encompasses that particular generation, which is us, the late Gen Xers, early millennials. That is what we were raised with, where it was all about dollars and saturation of entertainment. It didn't matter if it was appropriate or not. Just get kids to watch it. Get kids to eat it up. Get kids to buy it. Buy the cereal box. Empty the stuff out. Get the toy. That was us, man. And they don't get it.
I think you nailed it, because even the prime example I have is it was okay for me to see RoboCop, but Gremlins 2, that's a little iffy. So there was a standard of word of mouth between what was right and what was wrong. You have the hero element versus the goofy monster comedy that you had. So, and it was about a lot of marketing. You see an animated commercial for a robot cop, and that's okay because TV tells us it's okay because they're marketing it. So there is a bigger picture here. And one thing even today that parents don't understand, a lot of older generations don't understand, the more you push the no, the more we want to see it as kids. And this one has something that even takes it a little bit further. It has a curiosity about it. It has the temptation of monsters. It has the temptation of the darkness. And the tone itself is a curious thing for a kid. It's marketed as a kid's movie, but it is so dark that kids are going to be appealed to see this movie. And again, it goes into the main fact that they were wrong, that a lot of kids, and I'm not speaking for everybody, but a lot of kids hold this movie dear to their childhood because it actually did challenge and show something to kids that they weren't used to. It showed the darkness. On the cult war that we talked about, these dramatic tunes, This is one of those movies that really did kind of challenge a way we feel as kids to something that we're not used to. When sitting in a theater seat in front of the big screen, we see these dark images. We see a chemistry that is surrounded about building a friendship. And it really did push us to the limits of how we think and how we're viewing things, that not everything in the dark has to be treated as a negative.
I think what it does do, the way that they have this rhetoric, is that it does show that they have not only an ignorance, but they have a disrespect for the intelligence of children. And I think that Robin Williams and Mrs. Doubtfire sums it up perfectly in one of his lines of dialogue where he says, kids are little adults, like just treat them like adults in a sense, and they will understand. If you try and dumb it down too much for them, they're going to be bored. Try and get them interested in other topics by treating them and talking to them like adults. And that's what a lot of this content back in the day did. And when you take a kid's point of view without having any knowledge of what this generation's kids' minds were, it really reeks of ignorance, because you're not taking the opportunity to understand what this generation thinks, how they feel, and how they absorb their media. So that's why I say it's an ignorance and it's a disrespect to the intelligence of kids, because we all were told, oh yeah, this kid hit his brother with a baseball bat because he saw Beavis and Butthead do it. I'm not saying things like that didn't happen, but I'm going to say at least 99% of them were urban legends. It was something that a parent made up so you could tell your kid you didn't want him to watch that. If that was the case, man, we would have so many dead, broken, beat up kids in our world because of the stuff that we were subjected to, and that didn't happen. And we're still talking about that today with violent video games and violent movies and stuff like that. It's not that. It's the environment these kids are raised in, lived in. It might be a catalyst for some, but if you think about how many millions and billions of dollars have been spent on stuff like this by children and young adults in the last 50 years, it's not a pandemic. It never was. It's all just hyperbole. And these guys are kind of on that train with the way they review some of these movies.
This is one that really does drive me nuts, because I'm not going to go on a rant here, I promise myself. But at the same time, this is the era where conversations with kids didn't happen after film.
No, they did not.
So yeah, they really walk out of the theater. Did you like it? At best, did you like it? No, yes. Most of the kids at that time, probably yes. But there was nothing further than that. Here we are deeper into conversation and content mm-hmm. to really grow that appreciation for what they are seeing on screen. So to me, that didn't help the growth and the evolution of film for what we are censoring and what's being shown to kids. That's how we get all this trash of animated films and family films. We went through that 90s worth of those generic family movies, those safe movies, and now we're in this just generic animated family films that just feel like they come off of an assembly line, because conversations never had in the first place to really find out if our kids are being challenged enough. I feel like this is a whole other episode.
No, but this is the perfect movie to kind of like spark that conversation, because I think you're 100% right. And like I said at the beginning of the episode, studios aren't daring enough to make movies like this anymore. I'm sure there are plenty of screenwriters and directors out there that would jump at the chance to make a dangerous kids film again, but you're not going to see it because they care too much about what the fallout is going to be on social media. Even if it makes money, the fallout of how people respond to it and create like this bubbling disgust amongst the communities that don't even watch these movies to begin with, that is what's ruining entertainment. We talk about that a lot. So yeah, we are at the tail end of these kind of dangerous and obscene yet thought-provoking kids movies. Because I'm going to say, like, once 93, 94 hit, we kind of just stopped seeing them. And we were just seeing nothing but Jurassic Parks and volcano movies, you know, things that were no longer marketable to kids, but the entire family could come, get a little bit of a scare, get a little bit of a laugh, and they've just repeated that formula for the past 30 years.
100%. And it's one of those aspects of it that we can really look in just a decade worth of film where we can really knock on 80s to extremely early 90s movies and just say what went wrong and where did the greed really start. It's because of not necessarily just the studios, but the studios with the assumption of what audiences wanted. And it starts with the audience, and it starts with how we introduce the youth to film. And right now, the benefit of that is that it can be a restart. Mm-hmm. So not to stand on a soapbox, but we're seeing that with The Wild Robot now. We're seeing that with a lot of good films that are really trying to get kids to critically think, and not this studio trash that has a fourth and fifth sequels coming out that just do the same damn thing with the characters that are in just different scenarios.
Yeah, no, I think that we hit a lot of nails on the head today, sparking off a very random movie. And it wasn't my intention when I brought to this. I brought this to the show just because I knew how much they hated it. And I wanted to see if I could get on board with them, and I can't. So that being said, I'm not going to say that this is an F for Gene Siskel, because he is passionate in his message. He just doesn't think that kids should be subjected to movies like this. That's his opinion. It's fine. He brought a lot of good points. But at the same time, I think, again, he's missing the subtext that I think is so I'm not going to say delicately. It's there. It is there at face value. It's up to you as a viewer whether or not you want to accept the subtext of the film. And so with that, I'm going to give him a D on it.
This one's kind of hard. I'm going to be a little softer on Roger here because he's not wrong. Because I have to put myself in my rewatch mode. And I didn't see a lot of the stuff that I saw year over year until I knew this was coming to the show. And I really wanted to deep dive with the subtitles on and really watch this movie. So Roger isn't wrong in a lot of aspects. He really isn't, especially those that went in to see a one and done to get a review done. So he's not wrong. But at the same time, there is, like you said, just like Gene's review, there is underlying messages, but this one is so subtle that it is easily missed, especially with a lot of the visuals coming at you, where it almost acts as a subtle distraction to what the messaging is going to be. So even though I disagree with him, I have to be fair. I'm going to give him at least a 3-star on this one.
Okay, yeah, and that's fair. Like I said, it doesn't mean that they're bad critics when they score a movie like this, you know, low. I just really, I respect them so much, and I know how good they are at their job that I would like to see a little bit of respect paid to a film that, you know, has a lot more going for it than what they're showing you in the little clips and sound bites. But it wasn't my show. It was theirs. And that's how they chose to do it. And we'll just keep finding more episodes like this. But if I was to be a critic right now, would I rate this movie high critically? Probably not. I really wouldn't. But I think it is a very interesting film to go back and revisit. And I think it's one that should definitely be analyzed because there is so much going for this movie than its fart jokes and its peeing in bottles.
100%. And I think, again, this is one that I think with the if the technical aspects and the direction were in line, I think this could have been something fantastic for both age groups. And I think this could have been a lot more. And to me, I think that doesn't take away from my childhood like from it. I will still watch it. I will still rewatch it because it is part of my childhood. And we have those movies that we kind of have to separate ourselves and say, I know it's a bad movie. There's a ton of those out there, but I'm still going to enjoy watching this movie.
Okay, so how about this? Just to throw this at you quick with no preparation. Little Monsters or Drop Dead Fred?
Drop Dead Fred.
Drop Dead Fred 100%. But I also wouldn't kick Little Monsters out of bed. So
absolutely.
All right. Okay, so that is our take on that film. Now we are kind of getting towards the end of the year. We've just passed spooky season. We're almost to our year-end finale, you could say. And our films are getting really interesting as we're getting closer. So next week, Justin is bringing to the show, I feel like we missed our window when the remake came out. But I'm actually kind of fine with it because now we can actually avoid talking about the remake in this conversation, just focus on the movie. He's bringing the eternal classic, Alex Proyas's The Crow, starring Brandon Lee. And forget about the remake. This is where it's at. But what did our critics have to say about it? We'll find out next week.
Can't wait for that one. And forget it, the dumpster fire of the remake.
Right. Out of the theater within a week.
Well deserved.
Right, right. Well, here's the other thing, too. Throw this out there. You know, Joker's going to hang out in theaters for a while. It's not going to disappear like The Crow remake did because a lot of these studios had to sign a 3 or 5 week commitment, the theaters did, to have this theater, this movie playing, at least on a major screen. So it's going nuts right now with people hating this movie, getting low scores, people walking out. It's almost kind of epic, and I'm really, really happy to see stuff like this happen in the theater world these days. And the fact that movie theaters have to sit on this movie because they are entitled to with the contract, they can't just kick it out like they did with The Crow. I'm really excited to see what happens.
I'm the wrong guy to ask because I love musicals and I love the original. So, I mean, you know,
I know.
My opinion is going to be different.
We might have to do like a side episode on one of our shows to talk about that because it's a completely different beast. But anyway, so yes, tune in next week for The Crow. As always, please like, rate, review, subscribe, 5 stars, all that great stuff for Back to the Balcony. You can also find my other show, The Cultworthy Cinema Podcast on thecultworthy.com, and you can find Justin over at
themoviewire.com.
I also encourage you, please, to go visit our Letterbox. Follow us, we'll follow you back. You can see what Justin's seeing in the theater. You can see what I'm seeing at home and review for my other show and for this show. Read our thoughts, read our reviews, and just, you know, spread that movie love. And you know what? I can't wait for the start of the next season. That list is growing, but we could always use more. So please send us your suggestions. If there's a movie that Siskel and Ebert reviewed on their show that we haven't talked about and you want to hear us talk about it, send it to us and we'll add it to the list. Justin, it was a pleasure. I will see you next week.
See you next week.